Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Staten, and money-making Manhattan. You're listening to Bashani Radio App, the number one independent app for podcast. Download for free for iPhone and Android at the App Store.
Millionaire Mentorship. Millionaire Mentorship. The Millionaire Mentorship Show with Dr. Herbert Harris on Bashani Radio and iHeart Radio.
You are now tuned in to the Millionaire Mentorship Show with Dr. Herbert Harris on Bashani Radio. Always talking about everything from New York City. We are available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, and anywhere a mobile device is available. This is Dr. Herbert Harris, author of the 12 Universal Laws of Success. I am your transformational speaker and trainer. We've written 8 books, had our books translated into many languages, but we are now engaged in transforming the lives of 10 million people, helping them be what they want to be, do what they want to do, and have whatever they want to have.
Ooh, yeah. I got the power. The power's in my hands. And you only wish that you could understand. I got the power. The power's in my hands. And you only wish that you could understand.
Hey, everybody.
Hi.
It's me.
And me.
Dr. Herbert H.J. Harris, known from the rock-bound shores of Maine to the sunny shores of California, with Europe, Asia, and Australia thrown in simply for good measure, and my trusted assistant daughter, beautiful, intelligent, gifted young lady.
Known from the Rocky Mountains of New York to the sunny shores of New York.
See, I never laid that one on you before, that introduction.
I've heard it in passing. I've never experienced it in action.
Okay.
This is different.
All right. Oh. Well, anyway, folks, today we're here, and a part of our father-daughter series where we talk about racism, we talk about ways to confront racism and ways to overcome racism. And a lot of it is taken from our book, Solving the Race Issue in America. And I normally would have a copy of the book here, so you just have to visualize it. It's a black and white cover that says Solving the Race Issue in America.
Black, all black, white font, H.J. Harris on the bottom.
And we're doing our interview today from, really, it's almost like a museum, because we're going to be talking about the civil rights era in the 60s. And so what better than to have a real classic, this antique piece. It's known as Naugahyde, and it's virtually indestructible. It's fireproof, bulletproof, childproof, and drunkproof. So now that we have all those facts together here in the studio, we are ready to
ready to go.
So, Libby, what's your big thought today? What's on your mind today?
What's on my mind has been on my mind for several weeks, which is just as we, first of all, thank you for being my dad, for creating what you've created, and allowing me to participate in so much of what you do and showing me the ropes.
Well, it is my pleasure. I don't think it gets much better than that.
No.
To have a daughter who actually tolerates you and actually makes you feel like she likes working with you.
Sometimes I do. And sometimes it's true. But, you know, what I really, in being here with you so often and spending so much time, I've had a real opportunity to get to know parts of you that I probably only knew in passing in the past, and and that I took for granted or didn't understand at the time. And one of the pieces that I really had not seen from this standpoint where we are now is how much you as an individual person actually took action to make a difference in the world of race and socioeconomics in Wilmington, North Carolina. And I want to preface this by saying, for those of you who don't know, we're in Wilmington, North Carolina, which it's been in the news recently. We recently have a police chief, a black police chief. Is he the first?
Yes, first one.
First black police chief, 2020, doing it big. Huge drama because there were some police officers who were documented as saying, like, we're going to go kill some N-words and do a bunch of stuff. We have Confederate statues here on our regular thoroughfares, and they're currently being hidden by an unknown party has taken those statues and hidden them for safety so that whenever this all blows over, they can bring them back. So I say that because this city is a city full of a history of conflict, a history of conflict between the black and white community, and a history of, you know, just being deep in the middle of Jim Crow racism, every Reconstruction, all of the big things that affected our country, especially racially thus far. And so as a native Port City youth, as it said in the newspaper, Port City youth, my father, what can you say about Wilmington, its growth, and sort of where you come into play?
Well, you know, historically, Wilmington has been a pivotal city. As a matter of fact, I think I took you to the Burgoyne Wright House on the corner of 3rd and Market, which is like catacorner to two big Confederate statues that were moved in the last 24 hours. That house was the house, used to be called the Cornwallis House.
Yes.
During the Revolutionary War, when Cornwallis came through the South, through South Carolina, he came to Wilmington and made his headquarters there. So Wilmington has been a pivotal city since the beginning of the country. Then in 1898, and let's even go, during the Civil War, one of the last harbors that was open was the Wilmington Harbor and Fort Fisher. One of the final battles of the Civil War was the Battle of Fort Fisher. And we were down there the other day, and I mean, this was like huge. This was like the end. And after the Battle of Fort Fisher, there was the battle where the Confederate troops were retreating and the Union Army was coming, and they actually set up here in Wilmington after the war, and a lot of the Reconstruction was run through here. So it has a pivotal nature. And in 1898, there was just a piece on that. 1898 was called the coup of 1898. And it is a time when the upstanding, there were a number of things going on. The Raleigh News and Observer published a piece called the Declaration of White Independence, I think in November of 1898.
And I think to give a little backdrop for those who aren't as deeply into history as our family is, you know, one of the pieces I think that you kind of sort of said just in passing, but I think is really important, is that when the Union Army stationed itself in Wilmington, what that essentially did was enforce some of the policies of the Reconstruction era.
Yes.
Which then, like, if anybody remembers from history, U.S. history in 10th grade, you know, what they called the carpetbaggers, you know, people who were coming from the North who came to, you know, kind of start some new economies and work with, you know, black people in a totally new way, not as slaves, but possibly as politicians, as, like, you know, business people. And so, like, so at by 1898, Wilmington, because of its nature of having this heavy federal presence, was able to operate in ways that, like, really promoted and supported Black African-American girl.
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, Wilmington, the first Black graduate of MIT in 1888 was Robert R. Taylor from Wilmington. And so one of the things I think that Wilmington showed was that after the Civil War, during that period and that spirit of Reconstruction, that when white and Black people worked together, great things could be done. And so Edward Dudley, I think, who was one of the founders of A&T State University, was from Wilmington. Dr. James Schober was one of the first Black doctors in the country, and in the South was from Wilmington, a medical doctor. And so when you had these parties working together, great things had happened. And so,
and especially great things to the Black community.
Black community, yes. They thrived. The white community thrived. And in 1898, you actually had Black people who were aldermen. You had the harbor master, the man who ran the ships in Wilmington as a major harbor, was a Black man.
And I wanted to mention, because I did a little reading, because of you've been bringing up 1898 for years, and I didn't really get into it until recently. And one of the things I read in one of the, like, Raleigh did this big kind of blow up print about it. One of the things that they were discussing was this idea that that there was, see if I can get this right, there was a white populist movement. I'm not remembering what they were. It'll come to me. But they were a movement of, like, the white populist movement that was sort of supporting poor whites. And this Black newly elected political business group. And they had joined forces and created a government.
Yes.
And that government was governing Wilmington at that time of 1898.
Yes, exactly. And in the coup, the pretext for the coup was always something. A lady had written an article about, you know, Black men raping white women. The editor, as a matter of fact, Wilmington actually had a Black daily. The Daily Record was a daily newspaper.
Wow.
In 1898. And the editor wrote a response to her article, and that was kind of the pretext. And it was sort of a prelude to, you might say, Black Wall Street. It's what, 20-some years before. But in Wilmington, they actually used the Gatling gun. On the citizens here. And nobody ever knows how many Black citizens were killed. But I know that one of the major churches in March of 1898 had roughly 1,200 members. And by March of 1899, they had about 346 members.
Wow.
So, you know, I think back, I said, can you imagine that preacher's sermon that Sunday after the coup of 1898? You know, God loves you, so do I, goodbye. You know, some of these things you have to laugh at, because you say, man, can you imagine that sermon?
Yeah.
And there was literally, when you do research, the Star News, the newspaper, every day it sort of listed how many Black folks left town.
Wow.
You know, there was a news of the day. So this town has a rich history.
Yeah.
The last Black congressman in Congress after the Reconstruction was George Henry White, who's one of Sandra's relatives, a part of the Spaulding family.
Right.
And he left Congress in 1902. And I don't think there was another Black man in Congress for another 25 years or so.
Wow.
So Wilmington was almost a bellwether.
Right.
After 1898, and you couple that with Plessy versus Ferguson, which basically legitimatized segregation.
Yeah.
The separate but equal concept. From that point on, the rise of Jim Crow, the rise of all of the legal mechanisms that were used by the power structure, the white power structure, to control Black people and put them back into their place, as they say. So you won't be slaves, but you won't own anything, and you'll work virtually for free.
And just out of curiosity, like, the motive of 1898, like, the initial motive, like, there's the spark, there's the pretext of, you know, this woman writes a thing about, you know, being about rape and black men, and the black man responds and the white men get upset and they go, we gotta quote, you know, defend somebody's honor, or somebody's honor in there. But what would you say was the real, like, what's the real reason?
Well, the real reason was really set forth in the Declaration of White Independence, which was actually a written document.
Wow.
Where white people said they would never be ruled by black people.
Hmm.
And literally, it was like their God that they said that when, it's very interesting, they say when the founding fathers set up the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, they did not mean to include black people.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why often they say black people were counted as 3/5 of a person.
Right. You know?
So they, the Declaration of White Independence reaffirmed what is really playing out right now, because the contradiction, the moral contradiction that was there at the beginning of the country when they said all men are created equal with certain inalienable rights, they were lying.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so that moral contradiction keeps coming back again and again. And so 1898 was really about power.
Mm.
Let us take over. As a matter of fact, when they took over the city council, they wanted to do it legitimately.
Mm-hmm.
So they stood there with their guns and they had the current council members resign one at a time so the other council members could appoint new people.
Wow. So, and when you say, like, those members who resigned, who were, like, so were they only black people?
Oh, no, there was a combination, because you had, at that time, the Republican Party was kind of the party of Lincoln.
Right.
And then you had these other fusion parties coming along of people working together.
Fusion, that was the name of the party.
Yeah.
Fusion party.
Yeah. And so the powers that be wanted to eliminate that whole group.
Yeah.
And so they literally had them resign and institute. It was really a coup.
Yeah.
You know, it was sometimes they called a race riot, but it was not a race riot. It was a coup. It was an intentional coup.
Okay.
And then once the new people were put in place, there was a moneylender, businessman, I think Thomas Miller, who was a top, like a pawnbroker, a lender.
Yeah.
Had over 200 pieces of property.
Yeah.
And so when they ran people out of town, black people out of town, black people owned a lot of the land, and just out of attrition, that land began to turn back over to white people.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, I think there was a report that the courthouse had been burned to destroy the records.
Mm-hmm. So that even black people who did own couldn't
trace it and couldn't prove it.
Got it.
You know?
Got it.
And there were stories that when they came and tried to pay the taxes, people would let them. You know, this is the old day. You had to come pay your taxes in person.
Oh, yeah. So they were like, you.
Yeah.
That's a Negro.
Yeah.
He's coming to pay taxes.
Yeah. No.
Right.
Not today.
Not today. So I say this, so I wanted to create this really clear image of a Wilmington past, you know, and I was talking to a friend today about William Faulkner, you know, and the way that he writes in his literature, he writes a lot about how the South never really got over that the Civil War didn't go the way they thought it should.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, for the next 100 years, fought tooth and nail to make sure that, that like, somebody could keep what they had.
Yeah, the ideas of the South. You know, that at the end of the war, over the next 30 years or so, 40 years or so, that the land that had been confiscated from white landowners was returned to them.
Right.
The power shift took place.
Right.
And so there was a conscious national effort to undermine any advancement that black people had made during that time. And this is a part of this bigger picture that's kind of missed as we start talking about racism today. Because you say, well, how do black people get where they are? Well, there was a systematic plan.
Yeah.
So from 1898, then you had like 1907, in Auburn Street, Atlanta had been a mecca for black businesses, and literally that was destroyed. You had Florida, you had the most notable example, Black Wall Street
in Tulsa,
in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Yes. And so that was over about a 25-year period. And during that period, that power shift took place. The businesses were shut down, destroyed, people intimidated.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
To put folks back into their place, but now through the Jim Crow laws, to do it with the color of right.
Mm-hmm.
With the color
legality
of law.
Yeah. Right.
And so the Confederate statues and things that began to appear during that period were to really signal to black people that you're still under the philosophy of the Confederacy.
Yeah.
And, you know, you look at that pic, that was the Birth of a Nation.
Yeah.
That whole movie, I mean, that was like, whoa. But that was for real. And actually, at one point, there was actually a Ku Klux Klan party.
Right.
So,
as a political party.
As a political party.
So now we've set this state, and that, and I say that because that's kind of like the tenor of Wilmington through your childhood.
Yes.
And, you know, all the way, you know, like, it's one of those, like, for the foreseeable future, that's what it's going to look like.
Right. I tell you, I know we need a pause for the cause. We're doing a podcast, and I know that people around the world are just waiting to hear these little driblets of truth coming out. And so we're going to take a pause for the cause. This is Dr. Herbert Harris, and I want to tell you about our new book. Our new book is called Solving the Race Issue in America, and it's by H.J. Harris. That is my pseudonym for writing social consciousness books. But this book will give you a history of racism in America. It will help you understand what has worked and what has not worked and give you a spiritual solution. So go to www.solvingtheraceissue.com. That's www.solvingtheraceissue.com. And it'll tell you about our book, and you can click on it and get it on Amazon. The Kindle book is $3.99, and the paperback is $16.99. So be sure to get your copy of Solving the Race Issue in America by H.J. Harris. This is Dr. Herbert Harris, and you are tuned in to the Millionaire Mentorship Show on Vishani Radio, always talking about everything from New York City. We are available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, and anywhere a mobile device is available. And now, back to our program with more Daddy-Daughter Talks with me and my daughter, Olivia K. Harris.
So, talk to me about what happened at the end of the centennial of 1898.
Yeah, very interesting, and I think people need to pay note here, pay attention. The city founders, the city fathers, the powers that be, with the 100-year mark of 1898, a lot of changes had taken place.
Mm-hmm.
And so groups came together, white groups and black groups came together. We had a series of facilitated meetings where, to get away from people, you know, when there's a lot of anger, like what is happening now, there's a lot of anger, and so people want to holler at one another and call names, because they, as they say, as Reverend Al Sharpton said, you've had your knee on my neck for so long that now at least I think my neck is up. I'm going to holler. I'm going to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And so our way to handle that was we had facilitated meetings.
Mm-hmm.
White churches, black churches, people in the community came together, and there was a serious outreach, because we said, rather than try to hide this, because it had been hidden for 100 years,
right?
Let's bring it out and let's talk about it.
Mm. So I want to stop that right there, because I think this is, for me, one of the big reasons I wanted to have this conversation is we we've got to reconcile
yes.
our past with our present so that we can move forward into our future. And in order to reconcile it, we can't sweep it under the rug any longer. And we're seeing that. We're seeing the repercussions of sweeping something under the rug.
Yes.
And just hoping it didn't, you know, like yeah. Langston Hughes said, what happens to a dream deferred?
Mm-hmm.
And the very first word of that is actually Harlem. People mm-hmm. actually forget that because
yeah.
the part everyone remembers is a raisin in the sun. But he says, Harlem, what happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Does it fester like a sore mm-hmm. and then run?
Mm-hmm.
Does it stink like rotting meat?
Uh-huh.
And I'm gonna skip a couple.
Uh-huh.
And then it says, maybe it sags like a heavy load
mm-hmm.
or does it explode?
Exactly.
And it's exploding now.
Yeah.
You know, that's yeah. what's happening. This yeah. dream deferred, the American dream deferred, is exploding all over.
And that's a powerful thing. I mean, as someone said, a thought whose time has come is unstoppable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what we're seeing right now with even the president and the, you might say, the Republican part of the government, in there's a silence on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think there's a key point. Silence is consent.
Mm-hmm.
There's a beautiful, when we talk about the bully, there are three people in this whole bullying concept. There's the victim,
mm-hmm.
there's the bully, and there's the bystander.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people don't speak out, they're like the bystander in a bullying situation. When you see it, what's happening, and when you see the police brutality, when every day, I mean, from a Black community perspective, things have happened so often, we stop even paying attention. You know, it's like after a while, you just accept it as just, this is a terrible world. And when I get into the car and I drive as a Black man, I know I'm taking my life into my hands, and let me try to learn how to not get killed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so when you have that context, what we were doing in Wilmington was, let's get beyond that.
Yeah.
And let's sit and talk.
Yeah.
You know, what's your perspective of it? How do you see the Confederacy? What does it mean to you?
Mm.
And to respect each other's opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were saying before that I don't know that a white person can really give a valid opinion on systemic racism.
Mm-hmm.
Any more than I could give a valid opinion on... prejudice at the country club.
Right, you know? Right.
And so to really, out of respect for humanity, to say, I will listen to you and I will accept your version of it because I respect you as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And you would not be saying this if it were not so.
Like, I'm going to take your word
uh-huh.
as truth, and I'm going to take your truth as self-evident. Like,
yes.
I'm not going to question it. I'm not going to ask for receipts. I'm not going to be like, maybe it wasn't this way.
Yeah.
I'm just going to sit and take your truth
yes.
as a truth.
As a truth.
As a truth. And you know, like Plato,
uh-huh.
like the Platonic concept of like a capital T truth versus truth.
Yes.
There's like, there is truth for each person that we, you know, like you said, like there's all these different sides. There's a bully, there's a victim, there's a this, there's a that.
Uh-huh.
And all those different sides have a truth
yes.
of whatever they saw and however it was.
Yes.
And when we can, what I'm hearing you say is that when we can give space to everyone's truth without squashing someone else's truth or trying to knock somebody out the way,
yes.
there's an opportunity.
There's an opportunity. And it begins with respect.
Mm-hmm.
That when we can sit down at the table and say, okay, look, you know, that idea, in our book, we talk about the spiritual principle, that this idea of reclaiming our greatness, and it's the greatness of humanity,
mm-hmm.
you know, reclaiming the dignity of all people.
Yeah.
You know? And it cannot be done until we reclaim the dignity of Black people, because we have been the victims.
Right.
And so when we sat down in those meetings in Wilmington, we saw that we had misconceptions about what had happened to Black people. We knew what had happened.
Yeah.
But we had misconceptions about how white people saw it.
Mm.
And white people had misconceptions about how we saw our condition.
Uh-huh.
You know, white people often say, well, look, you know, you're here in America, the land of the free, the home of the brave, and if these things are happening to you, it's because you're not working hard enough.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, black people look at the situation like white people got all the money, got all the power. Let me just try to figure out a way to be left alone,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
to follow my dream but not get hurt.
Yeah.
You know, when I was at Tuskegee Institute and I saw what Booker T. Washington had done and walked in his home and whatnot, and one of the things that amazed me were the pictures on the wall of all the people who had come to his home and I would say pay homage, but who came to him to say, we believe in what you're doing. Mm. We want to see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from presidents. I think Teddy Roosevelt had been there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I said, in spite of that, they still had the syphilis experiment. In spite of that, black men were given syphilis and not treated and not told to see how it impacts people on a long-term basis. Literally were treated like animals.
Yeah.
You do that to a laboratory rat.
Yeah.
Same place where presidents had come.
Mm.
And so when you have these kind of contradictions, it's like, wait a minute, we gotta stop. We gotta stop, slow down, and let's listen with open minds. Let's set aside. And that's going to be the challenge, Libby, because so many people have accepted their version of reality that they can't hear anybody else's.
So just on this topic, because I think a lot of people, that's a very charged topic, very charged concept, that my version of reality isn't all there is. And certainly that if I'm a marginalized person, that how can I sit here and listen to somebody who's had all the power, all the money, all the whatever, and has, you know, materially benefited from my suffering?
Yes.
How do we, like, I would love to hear from, like, that perspective of that, those conversations in Wilmington.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what did it take? And what did you create from what those conversations did?
Well, one of the things we found was that once you start talking and agree not to get away, not to quit.
Uh-huh.
So that's just like, we're going to see this thing through.
Uh-huh.
We used to meet and we actually set up a community organization called the Community Action Group. And we wanted it to be a group that not only communicated, it grew out of the talks. After we had talked and communicated and we prayed and we sang, we can overcome together. He's saying, we're not going to go home. We're going to commit this vibration to action.
Yeah.
And so the Community Action Group grew out of that. And so people were prepared to be there.
Okay.
Because they had gone through the first phase.
Mm-hmm.
They'd gone through the conversation. When I sat down with one of the fourth generation of one of the men that signed the Declaration of White Independence.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat, as they say, at the table of brotherhood. And I could see him struggling, okay? Because at first he said, you know, what I think that mine was is his great-grandfather, you know, I can't second-guess him. And my question was, what is there to second-guess?
Mm-hmm.
If people were killed and this happened, then what is this? It was wrong then and it's wrong now.
Mm-hmm.
So can we at least agree that whatever he did was wrong?
Mm-hmm.
He's dead, so it ain't gonna bother him.
Yeah. Right?
But it helps us. As long as we hold things inside,
yeah,
we can't get past the block.
Yeah.
And so that idea of forgiveness, say, well, look, forgive my grandfather for whatever he did and forgive me for whatever you think I did.
Yeah.
Okay, you look at me from a black person looking at that person would say, well, you got six generations of wealth.
Yeah.
No wonder you have all this land and all this wealth. Nobody's tried to take it from you. Nobody erode and burned your house down when you tried to go for it. When you know, one of the things that fascinated me and when I was a kid is when white people said, well, there's nothing I can do about it.
Mm.
That's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, we say, well, you had all the advantage. I'm amazed you don't have more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. You're slacking.
Yeah.
You ought to pull up your bootstraps a little higher and start climbing.
But Dr. King had a beautiful saying. He said, it's very cruel to ask a man who has no boots to pull himself up by his bootstraps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And so that vibration, that communication,
yeah,
in moving to an action vibration,
yeah,
brought about the community action group where once a month we came together,
mm-hmm,
and it was facilitated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I led the meeting, and so when people came in, they were given an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important because people don't want to come to be beat up on.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. White folks don't want to come up to be yelled at and called all kinds of names, and Black folks don't want to come up to be yelled at and beat up.
Mm-hmm.
And so by having a written agenda, we all agreed on what we were going to talk about.
Right.
And we had a process. We had ground rules.
Yeah.
You know, this is how it goes. And, it, you know, in the beginning, you know, there was a little rocky there because, you know, like people who are very passionate about things, they want,
right,
to tell about, you know, their pain and their hurt. But see, if we just put it all in context, let's just do that. Then we can come together.
Right.
And once we started communicating, we saw that, for example, there was a school board issue about Black kids being arrested and, you know, in school, and 6-year-olds being taken out in handcuffs.
Mm.
I'm like, if anybody you can pick up, I don't think you have to arrest them. Okay.
Come here, let's go.
Yeah. Like, if I can pick you up and take you, I don't need to cuff you and,
right,
you know, arrest,
right,
you. I'll take you home to your mama.
Right,
okay?
Right.
And so we had that. And when we came together, once we articulated it, and then we came together, we started, the Board of Education was supportive. They,
mm-hmm,
said, well, maybe we need to get together with the teachers. And we found little things, like, for example, when the teachers, the first of the school year,
mm,
the teachers would have the list of names of kids in their class. Many of the Black kids had, I'll call them ethnic names.
Mm-hmm.
And so the teacher, maybe it looked like Keyshawn, and the young man wanted to be called Tyshawn.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the teacher would mispronounce his name, and his response would be, "That ain't my name." You know, you calling me out of my name.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So now, what's the teacher going to do for the rest of the year? She's not going to call him Tyshawn.
At all.
Okay.
Because she doesn't want to mess up his name.
They don't want to mess up his,
uh-huh,
name.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, Tyshawn is going to suffer because he's not a part of the education process.
Oh, because she can't pronounce his name.
There you go.
Yeah.
And so little things like that came out. And like, man. So how can we fix that? Say, well, why don't we do this? Let's have each child introduce themselves.
Hello.
Okay. So rather than read these names off the list, and as my friend Lou was saying, read it poorly, I might add. Okay. So rather than read these names off the list, why don't we just have the kids introduce themselves?
Genius.
Uh-huh.
And then you could just practice that.
And if you're really smart, get a little tape recorder.
And that's the whole thing.
Change the whole dynamic.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow.
So that was a part of it. And so as people began to come out, one of the things we noticed was that the older Black people were much more supportive.
Mm.
Because they had been through so much of the painful part of segregation.
Yeah.
That they were just amazed
that
white people came up to, and we had the meetings in the hood.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
That was important because we found that if you have a meeting at City Hall, many of the Black people had never been to City Hall, and City Hall is right next to the jail.
So
like,
they
don't think I want to go down there.
Right. Yeah. I don't want to get mistook on my way down.
Yeah, okay. So you had all these negative things going on.
Yeah.
So let's have the meeting in the hood.
Okay. Yeah.
And so many of the older Black people came out because they were just amazed
that white people
would come to the hood. And,
right,
you know, and the hood was so respectful. I mean, you know, whoever the folks were, the guys who were selling drugs, the prostitutes, all of that was there. But on that second Monday of the month, everybody took a powder. Okay.
He said, oh, I'm off today.
Okay.
They got the community action now.
And so...
I'm tickled. I will admit, I'm tickled by that. Well, they all sat down. They said, we're all going to have a big dinner. Let them do the talking.
Yeah.
The old folks talking. We'll have dinner.
And, you know, we had people in our group that connected with the fire department,
mm-hmm,
you know, because we were drawing such crowds. that, you know, we'd have 150, sometimes 200 people.
Wow.
And so the fire marshal, and everybody was on the fire marshal, instead of coming in with a, you know, like, you got to clear out, they'd pull over and pull one of our guys and say, listen, you got a few minutes, too many people here. Okay?
Right.
You
right.
know, just letting you know, okay? So don't let anybody else in.
Right.
All right. And the police were very supportive because, and what they found was, they didn't come in their uniforms.
Mm.
They came plain clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And they came, and their goal was not to sit and be policemen, but to come and sit and be citizens.
Mm.
One of the outgrowths of that was the, what they call the cops and communities, that the city council and the police department got together, and they made houses available, affordable houses, in the communities, in the black community, in the minority community, where the cops actually lived.
Wow.
It created a whole different vibration. I remember the cop up the street, he had a motorcycle, and we go by, and I mean, he had them, like, one of the biggest Harleys I'd ever seen, man. It made all kinds of noises.
Yeah.
You know? But he was, like, right up the street.
Yeah.
And so now, when something happened in the neighborhood, he would come over, and he'd say, well, what's happening, Mr. Harris? Oh, this is happening, that's happening. And he just walk over to the guy's house. Now, Bill, you know you're drunk. You shouldn't be up here raising all this hell. Okay? You need to go home and sleep it off.
Right. Okay?
And it worked fine.
Yeah.
But that was because when a lot of the racism and the experience that people have is because they don't know one another.
Mm.
They've never talked like friend to friend.
Yeah.
That they always talked to each other, from their respective point of view.
Yeah, yeah.
So that community action group grew into for 4 years. And every politician, the one thing we know about politicians and business people, they can see a good thing happening.
Okay. Nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm. So every politician who was running for governor, who was running for, I remember Elizabeth Dole came through and she was running for the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Every politician who was trying to do anything came through the community action group. And the beauty was everybody felt proud.
Mm.
We had Daughters of the Confederacy. We had ladies who, we had Daughters of the Confederacy, Daughters of the American Revolution, who came out.
Mm.
And, you know, it's just like, sometimes I'd scratch my head and I'm going like, man, that's amazing. And she wants to be there because she wanted a better city.
Mm.
You know, this one lady would come and she was like, well, I think Daughters of the Confederacy. And she would come and she would bring her little dog. And we had a young fellow named Jimmy, and he was a longshoreman. You know, he was a person you didn't mess with.
Yeah.
And whenever she would come, I said, Jimmy, Go get Miss Helen, okay? And sure enough, man, he'd get there and she'd come out with the dog and she'd sit in those meetings and she just loved it.
Mm.
Because there was such a vibration of love there. And we ended with a prayer, you know? And people couldn't wait to come back.
Mm.
Yeah? And even further, we talked about the education, that one key point we realized that people didn't understand a lot about government. That many black people felt left out, and many white people felt left out.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out that if you weren't in that power elite, that you felt something was going on that you didn't know anything about.
Yeah.
And so we started the community education series.
Mm-hmm.
And so people would come, and the universities are a great resource. I think as we prepare for this next elevation in the country, the universities and the churches.
Yeah.
Become pivotal.
Yeah.
You know, the churches have to really work at it because 11 a.m. is still the most segregated hour in the country.
Yeah.
But when the churches come together and the universities come together, it creates a foundation on which you can sit that table of brotherhood.
Hmm. Wow. I think we can stop there and give people some time. I wanted to just start this conversation because I think we're all starting to get kind of tired. Mm-hmm. And I mean as a country, we're starting to get kind of tired. Like, it's like people are, you're either tired of hearing about the stuff, you're tired of watching it, you're tired of it happening to you or people you love or people you care about. You're tired of feeling like there's no answer. You're tired of, some people are just tired of the protesters. Like, you know, there's a lot of things you could be tired of right now.
Yes, yes.
Like, lots of stuff.
Yeah.
Tired of COVID, tired of being in our houses, tired of not being able to go with life the way that we're used to doing it.
Yes.
But I wanted to put a seed in the ground, put a little water on it, you know, and put the soil down, because mm-hmm. I think that this is the beginning of a big conversation.
Mm.
And I wanted to put this here so that people could interact with this on my Facebook page, on your Facebook, on the Facebook of Solving the Race Issue, and start to, you know, just start to let that percolate so that we can start to put our eyes on the prize.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. And our Facebook page, Solving the Race Issue in America, we're going to have a lot of information there. Yeah. So those who love the gun and would follow it or like it, whatever.
Like it, follow it.
Yeah.
Herbert Harris of Life Skill Institute, self-published author,
mm-hmm.
Columbia University graduate, longtime attorney, campaign manager, musician, music producer. I just want to give people the idea of the hats mm-hmm. that you wear, because many of us are going to be in these kinds of worlds where we are the one bringing the light, and it doesn't matter what forum you bring it to, you're bringing it.
Exactly. And you know, I think the key, Olivia, is when you bring the light of truth.
Mm.
So you can bring the light of a lie
mm.
and people respond to it.
Mm.
But a lie eventually creates the negative.
Mm-hmm.
Truth creates the positive.
Mm.
And so when we can all come together and respect
mm-hmm.
truth,
mm-hmm.
dignity,
mm-hmm.
and love,
mm-hmm.
we can get this thing done.
Thank you. And so it is.
And so it is.
Thank you, everyone, for being with us today. I'm Olivia Kay. This is my father, Dr. Herbert Harris. And now we went from him introducing me to me introducing him. I think I took over the show. So it's time for our generation to take on the helmet and helm the whole thing. Let's go.
Next week, same time, same station, the Millionaire Mentorship Show, bringing you a whole new level of conscious, empowering information. I'm going to close out now with a song that we wrote and performed that I think is very apropos for where we are right now. And it is called "The Time to Love Is Here." Empty, singing a song the sad makes you kind of wonder why everything seems so bad. So many sad faces gazing into space, waiting for somebody else to make the world a better place. Leave it up to the other man or to another day. Everything goes down, be looking the other way. I say, come on, everybody, come on, everyone. The time to love is here, let these troubles, they be done. I tell you, come on, everybody, come on, everyone. The time to love is here, let these troubled days be done. And sit and wonder how things could be this way. I guess we'd better tell them this is a brand new day. Don't leave it up to the other man or to another day. Take
take your life into your hands. Make it work out your way. It's not the number of times you stumble down and fall upon the ground. It's the number of times you pick yourself up and keep on moving on to meet your goal. Come on, everybody. Come on, everyone. The time to love is here. Let these troubled days be done. I tell you, come on, everybody. Come on, everyone. The time to love is here. Let these troubled days be done.
This is Dr. Herbert Harris saying, you are tuned in to the Millionaire Mentorship Show on the Shiny Radio, always talking about everything from New York City. We're available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, and anywhere a mobile device is available.
Millionaire Mentorship. Millionaire Mentorship. The Millionaire Mentorship Show with Dr. Herbert Harris on Vashani Radio and iHeart Radio.
Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Staten, and money-making Manhattan. You're listening to Vashani Radio App, the number one independent app for podcast. Download for free for iPhone and Android at the App Store.